Welcome to the Doctors Making a Difference podcast, where we help physicians to be empowered with the tools they need to be successful in medicine, in finance, and in life. Join us as we highlight doctors and other professionals around the world who are making a difference. I really think you'll enjoy today's podcast. We get to hear from Dr. Josh Daly, pediatric cardiologist and academic faculty member at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and Arkansas Children's Hospital. He serves as the program fellowship director, and he co-directs the Personal and Professional Financial Essentials for Physicians course. So Dr. Daly is a sincere, kind person who is an accomplished pediatric cardiologist, but he's also a tumor survivor. This story is compelling and interesting and useful for every single person listening, and I know you'll enjoy it. Most physicians are great at making money, but terrible at growing it. You work 60-hour weeks while your savings sit in accounts earning basically nothing. NERP changes this. It's algorithmic trading designed specifically for busy professionals who don't have time to watch markets. AI-powered strategies that work while you're seeing patients. No day trading, no guesswork, just systematic wealth building designed for people with demanding careers. Built for physicians who want their money working as hard as they do. Check out start.nerp.com/doctors to learn more. NERP is a paid sponsor of this episode. All trading carries risk and results vary, so do your own research. This isn't financial advice. I'm pleased today to welcome Dr. Josh Daly. Dr. Daly, give me permission to call him Josh. Josh practices as a pediatric cardiologist in Arkansas, has a compelling, amazing story to tell, and I'm excited to be able to help him share that today. Josh, would you mind introducing yourself to our audience in more detail?
Sure. Peter, thanks so much for having me on. It is a pleasure to be here today. My name is Josh Daly. I serve as a pediatric cardiologist and live in Little Rock, Arkansas, with my wife, Lauren, and our four kids, spanning the ages from 5 to 15, so I have a very busy home life and work life. I work as an academic pediatric cardiologist, where I also serve as the fellowship program director. I teach a course on finances to all our fourth-year medical students, and then I write in the financial space and then do a lot of academic research as well.
It's a full life, like you said, because, well, and I think everybody listening to the program, most people are physicians, and I think everybody can relate, because once you're done with your training, then you're right in the thick of life somewhere, probably in your 30s, and a lot of people are married and have kids, and you're trying to build your career. And if you're in an academic setting, you're trying to publish and you're trying to build your practice. And then also just all the things we do in our communities and our churches and all the things that people live. But it's just interesting because you have to live this full whole life, but you have a super busy, interesting job. And you're no exception, it sounds like.
Yeah, that is very much the case. It is a constant balance that my wife and I try to walk in terms of discerning how to handle all the competing interests and where to invest our efforts and what to say yes and no to, as I'm sure so many of your listeners regularly experience.
Yeah. So I want to just lay a little bit of groundwork because I think it will inform our discussion a little bit later on. So tell me, just when you think back to why pediatric cardiology, what drew you to that, you know, to medicine and pediatric cardiology? Because it's a really long road to become a doctor and then to become a, you know, pediatrician and cardiologist. What drew you to that and kept you going through those education years?
Well, one, that in and of itself is an interesting story, in part because I think I made those decisions in one way. And one of the things I now do is research around how physicians make decisions, and in particular in the area of specialties. And so I can see my own story and how it diverged from best practices, even though I think it aligns with what's most common in terms of how physicians make those decisions. And as is typical, I thought I was making a rational decision and choosing based on what lined up in terms of pros cons lists and what made the most sense. But in reality, I think I was driven by my emotion. And so as I look back at myself and why I was drawn toward this, at the end of the day, we want to feel good about ourselves. And so we're drawn towards things that make us feel good about ourselves. And I felt like I was good in this space. So my undergrad is in physics. I'm naturally very comfortable with math and equations and thinking three-dimensionally. Got to medical school, it was a lot of memorization, which I'm not as naturally good at, nor had I had the training in that space. Then we suddenly came to cardiovascular physiology. It was something that came to me naturally, that fit with my background. So I felt like I had a high level of competence. In reality, I probably just had a background that lent itself toward that. And my ability to become excellent in other domains was probably high as well. But I found that I was drawn toward that because I felt like I would be good at it. And then I had a rotation with a mentor who seemed to like me a lot, and I hit it off with him quickly, and he thought I'd be great at it. And that just feeds our soul when we have that kind of relationship. So I remember vividly as a third year medical student announcing that I know what I am meant to do for the rest of my life. Wow. And I went down that path. Now, in retrospect, I think there's a lot of things I could have done and been a good doctor, had a meaningful life, and taking good care of patients, not just pediatric cardiology. I do think it's well suited to the things I enjoy and am good at, but it's not the only thing. There's a lot that I could have done. So one of the things I do with our third year medical students every year is I give them a talk on how we naturally select our specialty, what actually drives us, which are things like the affect heuristic, where we let emotion be our guide. It's a function of the way these limited experiences, and we assume that our experience as a learner on a given rotation faithfully reflects what it's like to be a practitioner in that space over a career. We assume that our current selves, the things we prioritize and what make us energized today, that will persist into our 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s without actually looking at the research about what drives human flourishing in those spaces. And what I try to do is pull back the curtain and show these are the things that really drive flourishing. These are the things you should prioritize. And these are the traps that we tend to fall into if we're not careful about how humans actually make decisions.
That's a really good construct, because you're right. I think we make it based on super limited experience. Mm-hmm. And how did I like that attending physician, and how do they treat me? And I'm a rural family doctor. I always thought I wanted to do that because that's what I knew growing up, and I love it. But I remember, probably like everybody, making a spreadsheet and deciding I like this or that, and kind of figuring out all the things based on my 20-something-year-old self, trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I remember during medical school, we had an obstetrics residency or obstetrics rotation. And for whatever reason, the personality dynamic in that group was rough. They were mean to each other, they were mean to me, they were mean to everybody. And I'm like, I want nothing to do with this. And then later in residency, I did obstetrics as part of my family medicine training. And I loved it. I'm like, this is one of the happy parts about medicine. There's so much sad. These guys are happy. 90% of the time it's party. And so I ended up I've practiced obstetrics these last 15 years, and I'm so glad I did. But anyway, I just reflecting on that idea, I wish, you know, that you had the wisdom of your 30s or 40s to make those decisions, but you can't really know how you're going to be happy going forward. So that's awesome that you're doing that for your learners. And I think that's probably a really valuable service.
Yeah, I love engaging in that space. And that even in and of itself is an example of how our interests and priorities can change. I knew nothing about this space, about how quality decision-making, the psychology that underpins that, and never thought that that would be a meaningful part of my job. And now I spend a lot of time doing my research and speaking in that space. And there's no way I could have anticipated it. Just that in and of itself is a good example of how interests and priorities can shift throughout a career in ways that we don't anticipate.
Yeah. So fast forward now, because I think this will draw back on this discussion in a little bit. You have been in practice for a number of years. You've got a busy family. Mm-hmm. You're going along, you're teaching, you're having all this influence on your patients and on the learners, and you've been writing in the financial space. You've done a lot of stuff. And then suddenly, one day, you found a health surprise. Do you mind telling us about that story? Because my listeners on the podcast know that I've had my own adventures with a huge tumor, and it's a rotten experience. But please share with us your experience on that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So about 5 years ago, I was in excellent state of health and had really had no meaningful medical struggles in my life. We had our fourth child, Ellie, and I found over the months after she was born that I was just tired a lot. And I attributed it to having a baby, being up at middle of the night, call, just the demands of life. At the time I was 39, and then in part getting older. I talked to my wife about it. She was a little bit concerned in typical male fashion. I was not, and just dismissed it and didn't do much. Finally, I saw my PCP and mentioned what was going on. We got some screening labs, and I was a little bit anemic and it wasn't really clear why. And then I asked him to send a testosterone level too. I'd read about men at age 39 and just the risk of that dropping. And my testosterone was in the toilet. It was like 27. Goodness. I mean, just basically extremely low. And so my PCP wanted to start my testosterone replacement, said, oh, this happens to guys at your age. Let's go ahead and just start you. So I did a little bit of reading and discovered that we should probably do some additional investigation.
Yeah, that's remarkably low. Replacement. That's super low. Wow.
Yeah, it was extremely low. So we got some additional labs, including an FSH and an LH, and they were really low as well. which most of your listeners are likely medical. But what that indicates is that it's not a primary issue of the gonads producing testosterone. It's something central in the brain that is causing those, because your LH and FSH should be very high in the setting of a low testosterone.
Right.
So meanwhile, this is in the middle of COVID. It's basically impossible to get an MRI in any reasonable time frame, in spite of being a physician at the university. And I try to schedule it. They're scheduling like 2 months out. Meanwhile, I've had a couple headaches, but one headache was right after getting a COVID shot. And I thought, oh, it's from that. The other headache was in the context of a viral illness. So I attributed those to that, blew it off. I even remember my wife and I having a little bit of a conflict where she said, this could be a brain tumor. I said, it's not a brain tumor. It's just a headache from a viral illness. Nothing I need to worry about. She reminds me of that regularly, by the way, how wrong I was in that space. But then I finally had a headache and it was up most of the night vomiting. And as any physician knows, that's a red flag for a brain tumor. So I go into the ER and have to wait a while, finally get seen, take advantage of the fact that I'm a physician working there, and basically call a resident I know. They get me kind of fast track and get the ball rolling. I have some friends that are neurosurgeons and others are neuroradiologists, figure out what sequencing I need on brain imaging, tell the resident that, get the whole ball rolling. Then the attending finally comes in. And the attending is somewhat perturbed that I have dictated my medical care and says it's inappropriate that I would do that and that they are not there to scan brains and that this can be done as an outpatient. I pushed back a lot, finally got a scan that night after being in the ER for most of the day, and it demonstrated a 2.5 by 3 centimeter mass filling my third ventricle, extending from my pituitary superiorly to my third ventricle, compressing my optic chiasm, extending into the hypothalamus. And so, interestingly, the radiologist initially thought it was a germinoma. And so I was admitted. I still vividly remember the neurosurgery intern coming down, who is just a few months in at that point into residency, trying to explain to me what's going on, telling me he's going to do a lumbar puncture as he's walked around kind of with the needle shaking. And I quickly asked him, how many of these have you done?
Right.
He's like, well, why don't you get the upper level resident? And so they do the full workup, all that to say they're convinced it's a germinoma, and so convinced that they wanted to proceed with radiation. Meanwhile, I'm sure I broke some rules, but I basically got a hold of my scan as quickly as I possibly could and sent it to everybody I knew. And I have multiple friends who are neuroradiologists. And in particular, one of the neuroradiologists who work at the Children's Hospital is fantastic. And I'm so grateful for him. He looked at it and he called me right away and said, they got this wrong. This is a craniopharyngioma. Do not let them radiate your head. So I ended up going back to the neurosurgeon who had told me it's a germinoma. I explained that to him. He's like, oh yeah, I was pretty sure that it was a craniopharyngioma. That's kind of what I thought too. I'm like, are you serious? Do you really think I'm going to buy that? That you're clearly were wrong. Just admit you're wrong. But anyway, I'm sure you've seen examples of that within medicine as well. So I did a lot of research, found out kind of who were the experts in this space, was told it was inoperable by some neurosurgeons, but found a neurosurgeon who had done a lot of these with excellent outcomes, who was very confident. So after a lot of prayer and wrestling with what to do, I underwent a complete resection. This is about 4.5 years ago now, and had an excellent result. He got the entirety of the tumor. It was a little bit of a rough recovery. My third cranial nerve was dinged, so my eye was fixed down and out, and then I had eyelid droop. So I wore an eye patch for about 6 months afterwards. And I had a little bit of pituitary deficiencies. I replaced testosterone and then thyroid hormone, but that was it. And basically returned to life as normal. And fast forward to last summer. So this is 3.5 years later, now 1 year ago. And I've been having MRIs initially every 6 months, and we just spaced it out to once a year. And I had an MRI 6 months prior to that with nothing whatsoever. And usually when they recur evidence of it within a few years, and they're supposed to recur slowly. Meanwhile, that summer, I started to have some just non-specific symptoms. I noticed I was a little bit more thirsty than normal, and I was urinating a little more frequently. I also just had a general malaise and lower energy. And then I noticed that my vision was just a little bit blurry, and I attributed it to I'm probably getting older and needing glasses. I had some initial labs just because in particular urination, I was within normal limits, but in retrospect was kind of tipping into some dysfunction. Then I was on vacation in Northern Michigan, and over a period of a week, my vision rapidly deteriorated. And I still vividly remember we're driving home with my whole family in the van, 16 hours from Northern Michigan and Little Rock, Arkansas. And I am struggling to see with clarity the car in front of me. So I start checking my peripheral vision, and I realize my peripheral vision is just fading before my eyes.
Really?
And I know enough to know what that means. That's this bitemporal hemianopia pattern that suggests there's something near the optic chiasm. And so, but even then, I didn't think it was the tumor recurring. They're not supposed to recur that far out after a clean MRI. I get back, get another scan. Basically, within 2 days, I pull some strings and I get it at my own children's hospital because the adult hospital can't work me in fast enough. So my friend, the same one that diagnosed it the first time, said, show up at 6 a.m. and we'll scan you before the day's pediatric imaging begins and I'll take care of you. So I get the scan. While I'm waiting, I go sit in our hospital's chapel, which is close by, the same chapel that I had sat in and counseled a number of families, but in the role as a physician. And then I get the call from my friend, the neuroradiologist, and he says, the tumor's recurred, bigger than it was last time, same spot.
Man.
And I quickly shift into, what are the next steps? What do I need to do now? I called my neurosurgeon right away. He and I had become friends. I had his cell phone number. And he, of course, as most neurosurgeons would want to do, was confident he could get it again and wanted to operate again. But you read the literature and redos are associated with a much higher complication rate. And the outcomes aren't that great. And in particular, if it's recurred once after a good surgery, the odds of it recurring again are very high. So as I kind of surveyed the literature, one of the things I recognized is there was this newer targeted therapy, which is basically like an oral chemotherapy that has been used in a variety of other kind of cancers, but it's been found in some limited series to really shrink specific type of craniopharyngiomas, the type I had. So I tracked down the oncologist who described this initial mutation and led the NIH trial where they looked at its evaluation. And she stepped out of a meeting in Tokyo and called me and said, we talked through the options, decided I wanted to try that, but I had to get a local oncologist to prescribe it. She was at Harvard, but was in Tokyo at a meeting at the time I talked to her. And I was able to find a local oncologist relatively quickly. Once again, took advantage of professional courtesy and called in a lot of favors from friends. There wasn't a single neuro-oncologist in my state at the time, which is crazy to me.
Right. Well, Arkansas is a big population state. Yeah.
No. Yeah. And I still don't quite understand how that happened, but that was the case. But I found a local oncologist who had functioned as the neuro-oncologist at our university for a few years when they didn't have somebody. So I had some familiarity. And he uses these exact same targeted therapy in melanoma and a variety of other cancers. So I was very comfortable with the meds, but just had never taken care of a craniopharyngioma. So he says, we'll figure this out together. So he spent 2 hours the night before seeing me, reading everything he could on this. Saw me the next day, got me this extremely expensive medication to start that very day, which was really incredible. Started taking it. And within a week, subjectively, my vision started to improve. And I know the placebo effect, that seemed really early to me. I got my vision formally checked 13 days after starting it. And it was significantly improved with very objective data. The day after I got my vision checked, I get the call from the pharmacist who says, well, your insurance has said they won't pay for it. They won't approve it. And here I know it's working. My vision's getting better. It's clearly working. And my own institution who self-insures has said, no, they won't pay for it, which really pissed me off. So I basically did everything I possibly could to make it as easy as possible for them to approve it and make it clear that it would go poorly if their own physician, they refused to pay for it for them. And I became blind. And I was grateful they reversed course. I recognize that's something available to me as a physician that the typical patient probably cannot advocate for themselves in that way. But I did. It got reversed. I remained on the medication. An MRI at 1 month after starting it showed the tumor already shrunk by volume by 80% with 1 month of BRAF and MEK inhibition, which is just extraordinary how well it works. So that was right at a year ago. Since then, it's continued to shrink and is now down to about 2 millimeters by 3 millimeters on my last MRI end of June. The hope is that we'll treat it entirely with this, that it'll go away and then we won't need to do radiation or surgery, but there's really limited long-term data using this kind of therapy. So we don't really know. There's a chance I may come off and I may come right back. Meanwhile, I tipped into panhypopituitarism. So my pituitary basically doesn't function anymore. So I have to replace all of its functions. So I have diabetes insipidus where I have to be very careful about the fluids I take in. I take regular medicine, which basically keeps me from peeing at all for a while. So I have to be real careful with my sodium levels. And then I have adrenal insufficiency. So I have to replace my adrenal function with steroids that I'm in the midst of trying to wean. And I actually just saw my oncologist this morning, and we were talking about coming down a little bit further because I've had some weight gain. Just the effects of long-term steroid use.
Yeah,
just constant balance. That's hard. So I am so grateful and feel so blessed that I've responded so well and the tumors melted away. There's also a reality that there's a certain medical fragility that I have that I'll likely have the rest of my life. And there's some real loss with that. There's some impact in terms of what my life can look like. Now I found a new norm, and there's so much that's good in my life, and so much of what I could do previously, I can still do, but there's real loss. So I've wrestled with feeling depressed and just some deep sadness around all of that. And something I'm still wrestling with. It's not like I've come to grips and everything is perfectly fine. I still struggle with the reality of that. But in the midst of that, I've been able to work full time. I have a great job in which I engage in deeply meaningful work. And I'm very involved at home with my kids and in my church and in so many of these other areas. And there's been some redemption, as is the case in so many areas. When something really difficult happens, that thing is not good. This tumor is in no way good. Yep. It is evil and a function of all sorts of ultimately the fall and all the ways that have impacted us as humans. And I dare not call that good, but I trust that God uses what is evil for good. And he's used that in my life. I am so much more grateful for the little things in my life. I have a perspective I never would have had before. And I've even shifted course. So last year I decided that while I'd always been kind of interested in this domain of decision-making, I had never really written broadly in that space and decided I was going to write a book. So I wrote a book this past year, and then actually have written two books, and both I have contracts are going to be coming out, but it's in this new space of integrating decision-making actually with my Christian faith and how you can bring those together and make decisions that really utilize best practices and minimize cognitive bias, but that also acknowledge the reality of God and the Bible and his leading in our life. So I wanted to integrate those. And I never would have tackled something like that had this not happened. So there have been some really good things that have come out of it. But the reality of the loss I still sit with every day.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you sharing the story. I want to reflect on a couple of things. Number one, because I've shared broadly on my podcast, I shared with you at the beginning, I've had a 26 centimeter tumor, and it was crazy to go through radiation and surgery and chemo and recovery. And I still have to take chemotherapy to this day, which kind of like you have to still babysit this thing forever. But what I found, kind of like what you just said, I found that I'm not afraid of anything anymore. Like, you've already told me that I'm going to die, or, you know, I have something that's an incurable, rare tumor that nobody quite knows how to treat. And so I'm just thankful for every day. And I don't feel like I need to be dismissive or rude or any of those kind of things, but I no longer am fearful. Like, I don't really care if people don't like what I said or what I do. I'm not going to be mean, but if I need to take something on, let's just do it. You know, like, there are no promised tomorrows. And I do think that there's a little bit of the element of the divine in this, because you realize how very fragile and how very mortal, how very human you are. And you only get to do this for a few decades at best. And if you are a good steward of your time and your talents and resources, hopefully you get to raise your kids, and maybe you get to live old enough to see your grandkids. And I hope that in that time that I leave some sort of positive impact on my family. Maybe nobody else will remember that I ever even existed. But I hope my children, I hope my patients, people that I directly impact, will help. And I'm just reflecting exactly what you said. I'm more grateful for every day. And when I come across something that is just rotten at work, where I'm just frustrated and doesn't work, I'm, you know what? But I get to be here. I don't know if I ever felt that quite before. I get to be here, and I'm here. I could be home, or I could be dead. I could be all these different things, but I'm here in the driver's seat as a doctor, still doing this meaningful, impactful work. And I'm so thankful for that opportunity. And it sounds like you've come to some of those same conclusions.
Yeah, very much so. That's probably the thing I'm most grateful for, is just the perspective. It almost makes it all worth it to have that perspective. Not quite yet.
Not quite.
I'd still rather I didn't have to go through it.
That's the same. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but if you're going to have trials, you may as well learn something from them.
You got it. Yeah, that's exactly right.
The other thing I was going to say is, you know, some of the listeners on this podcast are my fellow cancer patients. I have this solitary fibrous tumor. It's a rare type of sarcoma. I'm a physician. And with that comes tremendous knowledge and privilege. And my surgeon, who was actually my surgery mentor, precept leader when I was a medical student, I went back to her because I knew she was just a really great surgeon. So I went back to her when I did this horrible tumor cutout. And that's what she shared with me. She said, you know, it's the one benefit you have as a doctor, take advantage of it, that you can get some of these things done quickly. And that's been a real blessing for me personally. But as I talk to people, other people who have kind of rare tumors like this, a lot of them have what the experience you shared, Josh. Well, so-and-so wants to just put me on a treatment without really figuring it out. And so-and-so wants to just put me on radiation. Well, we never biopsied. We weren't sure what it was. And it's because it's rare. Like the things that you and I see every day, we're really good at. We see it all the time. I'm up to the date on all the literature. I know that all the experts, we can do great. Things that I've only seen once in my career, I mean, I can read about it, but I'm just not going to be amazing at it because it's something that's rare. And so there is being kind of a rare cancer patient and survivor, I do think is really an important thing to share. And you and I are physicians and we're grappling with that and find it to be difficult. And so I try to think about that for my patients. Like, okay, I'm telling you this thing, but I want to be right there with you. Let's walk through this journey, but I can't promise you that I know everything, but I can talk to the world's greatest experts and learn. That's informed how I interact with my patients a little bit. I wondered how that's impacted your experience as a physician as you interact with patients.
It definitely is. One, I have far more empathy than I did before. And not just empathy from the perspective, what is the medical pathology, but what is the reality of living with this disease and then navigating a very broken system? And variables that I may not have emphasized as much in the past, I now ask families about. And additionally, I'm now found I'm very clear and explicit in giving instruction and recommendations in terms of how families can navigate things. So in my space, as a pediatric cardiologist, I care for obviously the families of children with congenital heart disease, some with very complex heart disease that's very similar in so much it's rare. And there's very little that's designed for it. For instance, we use stents designed for livers in adults, and we figure out ways of making that work for a kid's heart. So right. It's a lot of that kind of stuff. And so what I'll often do with, in particular, parents, they're often somewhat at a loss. And I try to connect with them emotionally. I pray with them. I answer all their questions, but I also really try to encourage them and give them the permission to be advocates and to do their own research and become an expert in the space. And so this week I was talking to a family of a child that definitely needed heart disease, and they were deciding, is this something where I go to another center? Do I stay here? How do I pick a surgeon? Can I pick a surgeon? Or am I just left with whatever they tell me? And like giving them the license to say, no, I want this done, to go out and figure out, I would actually call this group, get a second opinion here. Giving instruction on how to do that, I think, has been freeing for a lot of these parents. And if you don't tell them to do that, the assumption is the medical system works, people will take care of me, and the right thing will happen. I wish it was that way. All of us in medicine understand that the system doesn't naturally produce the best result without advocacy by the family.
I think I sometimes tell my patients, they sometimes come to the doctor, or like I told you, I worked the last 24 hours in the ER and we had this conversation with somebody. Sometimes people come in and they feel like it's going to be Star Trek, you know, run your little scanner over and we'll just give you the laser treatment and you'll just be all better. But that medicine is messy. Even by the time you get a biopsy, the pathologists sometimes have to debate, is it this or that? And you know, there's so many different things where you just can't have certainty because the human body is very complex and you can only know what you know in real time. And so I do think that having walked that road myself as a patient, it sounds like you've done the same. I feel really motivated to help my patients. Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't try to talk about me, but I don't mind sharing my experience and say, hey, I've walked this road too. And let me tell you how this works. And if you have a problem, please don't just give up on it. Call me and I'll advocate for you. And I do think there's a tremendous need for doctors of all specialties to say, look, I'm not just a technician to check the box and check out. I'm here to be a healer. I'm here to help you to get through this difficult mortal trial that you're having. And maybe we can fix it. And maybe we can just make it better. And maybe we can't fix it. And we can just help understand kind of what that process looks like. And I'll mourn with you and work with you through that process. And that's come to mean a lot to me, a lot more deeply than it ever did before.
Yeah. Two observations I've made on physicians in particular in medicine from the perspective as a patient. One, I am so grateful for the one doctor in particular and a few more broadly who really strive for excellence. Not just, I do the basics, I'm going to be a reasonable doctor, but like Dr. Brastianos, who figured out this mutation, like she pushed the envelope. She's the one that figured this out. If she hadn't figured this out, I'm not sure I'd be alive today. Right. And so for people that push the envelope and strive for excellence, my oncologist who said, you know, this isn't really my wheelhouse, but I'm going to figure this out, and took 2 hours the night before and stayed up and read and really goes the extra mile and strives for excellence. There is something to be said for not just competence, but excellence. That's one of the things I'm so grateful for. And then I've recognized how broken our system is. There are good people, but good people within a system that's poorly designed. Still, there's lots of holes and lots of issues. And I'm so much more acutely aware of that than I was before.
Those are really important observations. And I, again, would not wish cancer on anybody. Tumors are rotten. But having gone through that, it gives you such a perspective. I'm also just not afraid to share some vulnerability with my patients. Like, I do not know the answer to this, but I will research this to death and I will call you and I'll call a specialist or I'll call somebody that knows more about this than I do and we'll figure it out together. And I know when I finished residency, there's this kind of like fake it till you make it sort of mentality. Like, yeah, I just got to proceed like I'm confident because I'm young and people are going to think that I'm just sort of a rookie and you want to kind of pretend. But really what people are looking for, they're not looking for someone that knows everything. If you want just a bunch of facts, just ask AI. You can find a bunch of facts. Yeah. You know, that's nothing. You're looking for someone that's going to integrate all these pieces of information and is going to say, I will advocate for you and we will find the answer and we'll fight this fight together. So anyway, I hear those reflections and things you're saying and I feel it and I'm inspired by what you're saying. So thanks for what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. It has been fun to have those reflections and an experience of the patient and then also get to simultaneously be a physician myself. And it's brought a renewed joy and a reminder that even something when I step into care for a patient with an atrial septal defect, in my mind, it's bread and butter. It's easy. No big deal. I recognize for that family what a huge deal that is. And the thought of their child having open heart surgery and all that they're going through. And I recognize how sacred that space is to step into it with them. And there's a renewed joy with getting to step in and help people in a way that most people don't get to do. We get to enter into the lives of someone at their time of greatest need and bring our competence and our skill and our caring and our love and step into that gap in a way most humans don't get to do. And that is a gift. And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is a unique and wonderful treasure to be able to do it. And when I thought it would be lost from me, I realized I was so honored to be able to return back. It sounds kind of cheesy, but like seriously, I just remember thinking like, I want to be a doctor. If I got to do it again, I would be a doctor. That's what I would want. And it just became so much more meaningful. So I want to shift for just a minute and talk a little bit about, you know, you write about financial space, you do preparation, do some financial education to some of your learners that are in your institution. You write for the White Coat Investor. I mean, you've done a bunch of stuff to try to magnify your talents in this area. One of the things specifically I wanted to ask you is about disability insurance. Most of the listeners on the program, like I say, are physicians. And like you and I talked a little bit before we hit record, we hear the statistics. We all know that we're supposed to have disability insurance, but man, when you go through something like this, when you're pretty young, you know, I think you were 39 when that started. I was 43 when I found I probably had this tumor for several years prior and just didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And it suddenly becomes really important and you realize that. So walk us through that experience. When you found that, how did this impact you from a kind of financial consideration standpoint or what you were thinking about with the disability insurance that you had?
Yeah. So one, I'm very grateful that I was exposed to a lot of high quality financial education early in my career. And a lot of it through the White Coat Investor. Stumbled across them in residency and have basically read most of what they published ever since. And it was really like my eyes were open to this space. And part of it is I also really enjoyed it. So I ended up reading everything I could. And then I started with giving a couple lectures and that expanded to teaching an entire course and then writing in that space and really enjoy it. And I knew that I should have term life insurance and disability policy. And I had those in place, but I never really envisioned it being in a scenario where I needed that. It wasn't visceral. I knew I thought the odds were extremely low and I never really, it was more just a box to check. Once I was diagnosed, what I had, I had. There was no getting more life insurance, no getting more disability at all. And I'm grateful I had reasonable policies in place. Yet I also realized I'd made some mistakes. In the term life insurance space, I had not bought as much as I would have ideally bought. At the time, I just had my fourth kid, and I started doing the math on if I died, how much money my wife would actually need to maintain her standard of living, care for the kids, and not have to go back to work. And it was more than the life insurance I had. And they could make things work, but it wasn't going to be nearly as comfortable as I thought. So I developed a whole financial plan if I died. about how they should spend money, where their various sources were. And I stumbled across some other sources. I knew very little about, like, Social Security survivor benefits are actually relatively generous into someone like my situation has multiple young children at home. So my wife had a lot of money in that front. So I had a reasonable policy, still have not been able to buy anymore. At this point, our net worth has grown that in combination with that, I think my family would be fine, but I still would go back and buy more. On the disability policy front, I had a reasonable policy. It's not the best, but it's not the worst. Especially when I was diagnosed the second time a year ago, I met with a disability attorney right away to make sure that I was doing the things necessary to make sure that I would qualify, because there was a very real chance my vision was going to continue to deteriorate. And you cannot be an imaging cardiologist if you're blind.
Nope.
I mean, there's no way. And his overall assessment was I had a reasonable policy. Sure, we'd get a few things different if we were to go back and do it. And it overall should pay out. And I'm grateful that in my case, disability would be a little more black and white. There are many cases in which there are shades of gray. If you're alive or dead, that's black and white. Life insurance is really straightforward. Right. Disability is very, very different. There's all sorts of different definitions of disability. In my case, if I became blind from a tumor that's clearly in my brain, I would have qualified. But there's lots of other cases in which it may not. So I'm grateful that my vision recovered. I haven't had to take any meaningful time off from work. My disability policy, I haven't had to use it, but I know it's in place. Now, one of the things I somewhat regret is it is actually tied partially to my employer. It's a little bit complicated in that I can take some of it with me, but some of it I could not if I were to move jobs. So I love my job. I don't plan on going anywhere, but if I had been recruited to another place and wanted to move, I'd be very limited at this point because I couldn't go out and get a new policy. There's no way anyone would approve me. So I'm a little bit stuck where I'm at. Now, I love where I'm at. I have no intention to leave, but I hadn't anticipated how all that would play out on the front end. But my hope is that anyone listening would look at the two of us and recognize this can happen to anybody. This could happen to you. Even take a moment and just like close your eyes and envision what that would feel like to be diagnosed with something like that. What are the things that you would regret in that scenario? And what are the practical steps you could take? One of the practical steps, if you have dependents, you got to get term life insurance. And regardless of the presence of dependents, you have to get a good disability policy.
Yeah, I totally agree. Similar, I had a reasonable policy. I have been a devotee of the White Coat Investor for a lot of years. I listened and I got a policy about 10 years prior to diagnosis, just, you know, an individually underwritten policy, and they're expensive. And I was like, oh, that's expensive. It's hard. But the mistake I made wasn't, I don't think I bought a bad policy. The mistake I made is it would have been pretty easy in the intervening years to examine my income, our spending, and, you know, just all that stuff, and just go and update it and say, okay, the intent is to replace 60% of your income because you're not paying taxes on that money when you get disability payments. And I wish that I had gone and investigated because it was a great policy when I was 33 years old. It was an inadequate policy when I was 43 years old. It was still good. We'd survive. We'd live. We'd figure out a way. But I just exactly reflect what you said. If you're listening, you're listening to two guys who are pretty, we're young, right? Two guys who got this disease, you know, in their late 30s, early 40s, who did nothing wrong. And you just get illness. It's not all cardiometabolic disease. There's so many other things that can show up. So I just want to leave that message with our audience. As we come up to the end of our time, I wanted to give you a chance to give us any final thoughts you had and then leave us with some information of how people could get a hold of you if they say, I really want to follow Josh Daly's work.
Yeah. So one, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure to be here. For anyone interested in following my work, the easiest way is to go to my website, joshdaly.com, D-A-I-L-Y. And I have links there. I have a Substack where I write, especially in the area of decision-making, links to the work I do in the White Coat Investor and some other sources too. That's the easiest way to find me. If I were to leave you, the audience, with one primary area of encouragement, I think it comes from the story of Alfred Nobel. For many, everyone knows the Nobel Peace Prize. You may not know where that came from. So he's an individual that had generated incredible wealth, basically in the domain of warfare, in terms of what he had developed. And his brother died, and a newspaper thought that he had died and wrote his obituary as if he had died. And he read his obituary, and it was basically a legacy of death that he had left the way it had been described. And it was this turning point for him where he recognized that is not what he wants his legacy to be. So he took his wealth and created the Nobel Peace Prize and has done an incredible amount of good throughout the years. And I would encourage anyone listening today that you could be in our shoes. Now, I'm grateful neither of us have died and neither of us are disabled at the moment. That could easily happen to either one of us. But you could be in this situation where you could die prematurely or have a significant disability. What would your obituary say? What would your loved ones write about you? And what would you like it to say? Take advantage of this moment and wrestle with that. And then you have the opportunity to make some differences. I just wrote, as part of kind of this men's group I'm in, we wrote a letter from ourselves on our deathbed to ourselves today, imagining what that felt like, communicating regrets, things you're grateful for. But there's something to be said for that perspective that comes on the deathbed about what really matters in life. And what are the things that we emphasize and prioritize that just don't matter that much in the grand scheme of things? But take a moment and engage in that exercise and think, what would your obituary say? What would you like it to say? And what can you go out and do differently to make sure that your life is aligned with the things that you value the most?
That's such great wisdom. Dr. Josh Daly, thank you so much for joining us. Please keep in touch, and I look forward to seeing you down the road. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter. It's been great being here.
Thanks for tuning into the Doctors Making a Difference podcast. And thank you for what you do to help your patients and your community. Your work truly helps so many people. We produce this content to help you have the tools you need to stay in medicine and to highlight the amazing work being done by physicians around the world. Please note that while I am a physician, and many of the guests on this program are also physicians or other professionals, the discussions on this podcast do not represent my employer or any professional organizations to which I belong. This podcast is for your information and entertainment only, and should not be taken as professional advice. You should seek appropriate professional advice pertaining to your own situation. Please check out more of our content on our website, doctorsmakingadifference.com. Also, please follow, like, or subscribe on your podcast player or YouTube channel and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps to spread the message. Finally, if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, or if you'd like to nominate someone else to be a guest, please visit the website or email admin@doctorsmakingadifference.com. See you next time.